welcome to the May episode of the Our Science podcast, bringing you all the latest highlights from around the Royal Society. I'm Eleanor Beale.
And I'm Victoria Drews.
This month, we've got a fascinating extract from a recent popular event, Bill Bryson in conversation with Jim Al-Khalili. Stay tuned to him talking about how he felt writing about science from an outside perspective and some of the challenges that were involved.
But before that, there's plenty more to catch up on. We'll be highlighting sessions from the Royal Society's Research Fellows Conference, including a panel discussion on the role of creativity in science. We'll also hear from experts on science education and the recent SCORE conference, looking at the place of science in school curriculums.
But first up, Professor Peter Fakusic recently received the Royal Society's Cone Award for his high-quality public engagement activities. Receiving the award, he delivered the Cone Award lecture here at the Royal Society, and we caught up with him beforehand when he told us about his work in Africa and why he thinks it's important for scientists to engage with the public, and particularly with young people.
Peter, you are a professor of biophotonic. Can you explain what biophotonic is?
Yes. So photonics perhaps needs a little bit of clarification, and that relates to light and colour. The control, the manipulation of the flow of light and colour. So the overall phrase, biophotonics, really refers to how biology uses, manipulates, controls light and colour for functional purposes. And often, while there's clearly a biological purpose to that and a long track of evolutionary adaptation, from the physics point of view, the mechanisms with which light and colour are manipulated are extremely interesting. And so that's why it's a fruitful and a wonderful area for study, the biological world and how it uses light and colour.
So you've been awarded the Cone Award today for your work in science outreach. And you've done some really interesting work with science in schools in Africa. Could you tell us a bit more about this project?
Sure, yes. So for many years I've been working here in the UK, but I felt I needed to reach out a little bit further geographically, in a sense. And so deprived pupils, school students in Africa seemed to be one of the appropriate areas. So I looked into it, and with the help of several really generous people, we were able to arrange for me to visit schools first in Ethiopia and then in Malawi, really rural, deprived schools out in the sticks. And it was a transformational experience for me. It was a wonderful opportunity to get in and to try to inspire these pupils whose education is normally relatively limited and rather dry and homiletic. So I really felt like I was just spreading the word of this wonderful world of physics and science that's out there, and that all they needed to do was just to read and have some hunger to learn about it.
That's really fantastic. You've also founded the Girls in Physics Initiative at the University of Exeter. What does this entail?
Like many colleagues in physics, teachers and lecturers in physics alongside me and before me, we look out at the sea of faces in our lecture rooms and see rather few girls' faces in the undergraduate, certainly, audiences. And this is a terrible tragedy. Many of us think that. There are many reasons behind those numbers. And recently, the Institute of Physics published a paper describing their research into why it's just so hard to get girls interested and applying for physics degrees. So as part of that, and as part of the whole movement towards equality in physics education, I came up with this idea of using some dynamic and energetic and really bright female undergraduate and postgraduate physicists at Exeter, who are around us all the time down there, and we teach them and we interact with them. And I just asked them, would they be interested in going into schools and behaving as role models for these young girls who perhaps haven't had appropriate scientific role models who were women? And they jumped at the chance. And these undergrad and postgrad girls who do this are just tremendous. And they put me and my colleagues to shame with their insight and their innovation and their delivery. So in a sense, I've been a conduit. I've been able just to arrange the schools. I've helped them with preparing their talks and content and really guiding them with respect to the protocol of what to do in classrooms and how best to engage. And then it was all up to them, apart from a taxi service that I supplied, kept driving them around to these schools. But it was wonderful just to see them mature and to see the girls in the audience really get hold of these ideas. So that was the the very modest Girls in Physics program.
Great. Do you think it's important for scientists to engage with science and education outreach?
Well, the future of science is in the young people who are in schools currently, and if not many of them come through as professional scientists, whether in industry or in academia, then the scientific future will be very limited, not least to talk about the competitiveness of the UK in science terms. So it's important for everyone who's a professional scientist, whether at university or technology, or even if you have a part-time interest but you have a passion to communicate science. The young people are just hungry for this information. And if you can go into a classroom or a society and speak in enthusiastic terms with some knowledge behind you, of course, then there is always an opportunity to do that. And it's such a valuable thing to do.
You can watch Professor Fakusic's lecture in full on our website.
We hosted our Research Fellows Conference in March 2014. The Royal Society funds a range of fellowships for scientists across the natural sciences, and the conference is an opportunity for them to get together to learn more about each other's research and to discuss multidisciplinary topics. Eleanor caught up with a couple of the attendees to find out what they were doing with their fellowships and what they made of the event.
I'm Stephen Graham. I work at the University of Cambridge in the Department of Pathology. The research I do is looking at how viruses infect cells and how they then utilize proteins inside those cells to either subvert, so hijack and dampen down the immune response to the infection, and also how they use those proteins to assemble and then get out of cells so they can infect other cells. And I'm a Sir Henry Dale Fellow, which is funded by the Wellcome Trust and the Royal Society. So I've had my fellowship for about 16 months now, and it's been really great because it's allowed me to start an independent research laboratory and start tackling some problems which I've been interested in for a long time, but didn't have the freedom to really work on full time until now. I always find events like this great because it's really amazing to see the breadth of different work that people do, and also it's interesting to see that even though the topics they might be investigating are very different, the driving motivation behind it is always to further knowledge, and also to see that other people are using other techniques that are very interesting that might be applicable to my research.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Shorge, and I am from University College London, and I am looking at ion channels in human disease, specifically trying to develop a gene therapy treatment for epilepsy.
So you're one of our research fellows, so can you say a bit about your fellowship?
I got this fellowship in 2010, so I'm almost 4 years into it, and it's been a fantastic chance to really to stay in science. And it has allowed me not only to stay in London, but to publish really the first effective gene therapy for epilepsy, and also to build a big telemetry unit for following seizures in all of our models of epilepsy. And that is something we wouldn't have been able to do.
So we're here at the Research Fellows Conference. Can you say a bit about some of your highlights so far, some things that you're looking forward to about being here?
It's almost like giving your brain a sideways workout, because the talks have been arranged so that they alternate from one side of science to the other side of science and back again. So we had a lecture on turbulence in jet planes yesterday, and I know nothing about that apart from when the seatbelt light goes on to fasten my seatbelt. And having listened to the lecture, I now feel that I know, not only do I know something about it, but I feel like I will be following it and looking into what's going on. And we're in the breakout sessions, and I am now just looking forward to hearing about things that I never thought I would look forward to hearing about, and things that I didn't even know what they were. As a little side project, I've been talking to particle physicists, and I'm a neuroscientist, so my knowledge about particle physicists can comfortably fit on a postage stamp. And I am, after having talked to three or four of them, not only are they bouncing ideas off of me to see what I understand so they know at what level to pitch their talk, but I'm finally beginning to understand the difference between an up quark and a charm quark, which is very exciting for a neuroscientist.
One of the sessions at the Research Fellows Conference was a panel discussion on creativity in science. We asked the chair, Professor Francis Ashcroft, and Andy Cohen, who's head of the BBC Science Unit, what they think about the subject.
Well, we all understand that creativity is really the bedrock of science. All great scientists are distinguished by their ability to come up with new ideas and to think about things in new ways. generate new inventions, perhaps. And in general, those ideas are ones that seem so incredibly obvious once they're articulated, but so difficult to have conceived of before that was the case. So the aim of the discussion tonight is to try to understand what creativity is, how we recognize it in individuals, how we can encourage it in people, what kind of infrastructure is conducive to creative thought, and so on.
Do you think that maybe sometimes people don't see science as a creative discipline necessarily?
No, I don't think so. And I certainly don't think any scientist would agree to that statement. I suppose people sometimes think that because creativity essentially means making things, this is making ceramics or paintings or works of art. But in fact, science is no different really from being creative in writing a novel or generating new ideas. Because after all, what you do when you're a scientist is come up with lots and lots of different ideas. And then the difference is that although you're very imaginative, you have to constrain that by the existing scientific knowledge. I think Feynman put it very well. He said that science is imagination in a straitjacket. And that's exactly right.
Oh, that's really interesting. So who do you have on your panel today to talk about creativity?
Four people. We have Professor Geoffrey Bolton, who's from Edinburgh University. We've got Professor Ottoline Laser, who's a plant biologist and a director of the Sainsbury Laboratory at Cambridge University. And then we've got Andrew Cohen, who's the head of science at the BBC, and Professor Syringhus, who's the professor of electron device physics at Cambridge University, and also has founded his own startup company. So they're all highly creative individuals, and they're all have long experience of nurturing creativity in other individuals.
So I'm here with Andrew Cohen from the BBC. Andrew, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yes, I am. I'm a failed doctor and currently head of the BBC Science Unit. I think the quickest way that I can describe what I do. I look after all of the television documentary output, science output at the BBC on BBC 1, 2, 3 and 4.
Great. So you're here at the Royal Society today at the Research Fellows Conference to sit on a panel on perspectives in creativity and science. Can you tell me a little bit about this and what you think it means?
Well, I'm hoping to find out exactly what it means. It's one of those weird things when you sort of kind of talk about creativity and science, because I mean, every endeavor, as far as I'm concerned, is creative. There's nothing that we can't do that doesn't sort of need a spurt of creativity in it. So, and I think science is one of those interesting areas where, because you know, we think of it about being so logical, about it being so sort of focused on detail, that we think we have to squeeze creativity out of it. But if you look at the great discoveries through the centuries, there's a massive sprinkling of creativity wherever you look. So that's what makes science so fascinating, really. It's about that combination of creative spark, that eureka moment, that moment of inspiration, combined with incredibly hard, detailed work.
There might be this perception in the public that maybe scientists are not really creative. Do you think that shows, like documentaries or shows about science on the BBC or other television channels, can help change that idea or change the perspective that scientists are not necessarily creative?
I think there's a balance to be struck in how television represents creativity, because on the one hand, we can skew the perception of science that it's all about kind of really clever people sitting in rooms and having a moment of inspiration that changes our view of the universe. And you know, that's quite tempting for television makers, because that's kind of it, that fits a stereotype that's quite enticing. But obviously that's not real, that's not reality, that's not truthful representation. So, but on the other hand, what we don't want to do is just make the process of science seem so kind of dry and difficult that we put people off wanting to engage with science or be scientists themselves. So I think we look in terms of communicating science, we look to try and balance that, although I think probably more of the time we're on the moments, the fleeting moments of inspiration.
You can find out more about our funding schemes on the grants section of our website, where you can also search our Research Fellows database. Just visit royalsociety.org/grants.
The Royal Society also recently hosted a gathering of science education specialists, the SCORE Conference. SCORE is a partnership of organisations, which includes the Royal Society, which aims to improve science education in UK schools and colleges by supporting the development and implementation of effective education policy.
Teachers, researchers and policymakers came together at the conference to discuss the place of science in the school curriculum for students aged 14 to 16. We had a chat with Julia Buckingham, the chair of SCORE, and Professor Michael Rees, who was speaking at the conference, to find out more on the subject.
So I'm here with Professor Julia Buckingham at the SCORE conference. Julia, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Certainly, yes. I'm an academic. I studied pharmacology as a young scientist, and I developed a big interest in drug discovery. My own research concentrated on how the body responds to stress, and I've always been interested in trying to understand how stress hormones act on the brain and how those actions of stress hormones influence our behavior and our metabolism.
And what do you do now?
My current job is as chair of SCORE, but I'm also vice chancellor of Brunel University, which is in London. Brunel is a very science-based university with a very strong focus on engineering, so I'm able to bring my background in science very much to bear in much of what I do within the university.
So you're here at the SCORE conference, actually you're chairing the SCORE conference. Can you tell us a little bit, what is SCORE?
Indeed, SCORE is a partnership between five organisations: the Association for Science Educators, the Royal Society, the Institute of Physics, the Royal Society of Chemistry, and the Society for Biology. And what we do is to work collectively to try and develop evidence-based policy on science education. So we're both, I suppose, reactive and proactive in our approach. We respond to all sorts of publications and consultations which come out about science education in schools, and we focus very much on schools, and we try to respond in a positive and constructive way and to be helpful. But we're also proactive in that we think very much about where science education is going and how science education should be formulated.
And what's the topic of the conference today?
Well, today we're thinking about the very challenging topic of, is 14 the right time for young people to make a decision as to whether they should or shouldn't study science?
And do you have a personal take on this particular issue?
Well, I believe very much in people being able to keep their doors open. I think we live in a world where science impacts on absolutely everything that we do. And in an ideal world, I would like to see all our young people being what we now call scientifically literate. So I would certainly encourage science education for all, not just at 14, but way beyond 14. I think it's very, very important. I think there's a difficult question about when people decide about whether they really want to specialise in science, and that's a very, very different issue. I broadly favour a broad education. I think there's an enormous value in people having the opportunity to study many different subjects, the humanities, the arts, languages, and science, up until the age of 18, and I'm a very, very strong fan of the International Baccalaureate because I think it encourages people to think and to think broadly and to develop very good analytical skills.
My position at the Institute of Education in the University of London is Professor of Science Education, but I'm also what we call Pro-Director for Research and Development, which means that I look across the whole portfolio of our research work and new activities, and then I spend quite a bit of time teaching doctoral students and keeping on top of policy issues in science education.
Okay. And what areas of science education are you looking at?
I've been doing a lot of work recently about what is it that causes some people to continue with science after the age of 16, or depending on countries, when it's no longer compulsory, because the answers are not exactly what many people expect, and that's quite important for continuity people going on to higher education in science. I'm also doing quite a lot at the moment about practical work and how we should assess it, because this is quite a topical issue in England and it's important we get answers soon.
Great. So you're here at the SCORE conference at the Royal Society, and you're going to be chairing a session entitled, Is 14 the Right Age at Which to Make Subject Choices in Science? What's your take on the whole issue?
It's so interesting because when I started being a school teacher, it was in the days before GCSEs and the national curriculum. So the reality was that most young people in schools in England pretty much knew when they arrived at their secondary schools, usually at the age of 11, whether they were going to do CSEs or O-levels. And if they didn't know, the reality was that their teachers, certainly within a few months, knew. And that was the big choice that you made then. What then happened was you chose at age 14 whether to continue with biology and chemistry or just biology or chemistry and physics or some mixture and so on, and that was pretty important. When the national curriculum came in 1989, a lot of us were very positive because we moved to a situation where over four-fifths of the entire cohort did what was then called double award, GCSE. In other words, a balanced science typically occupying 20% of the school timetable, which include physics, chemistry, biology, and little bits of astronomy and earth science. What's happened, of course, in recent years is we've moved towards a multiplicity of routes. We keep in this country failing to get on top of adequate vocational choices, and so young people continue to end up mostly doing different GCSEs. But of course, we've had the growth in separate sciences, so-called triple science, and I'm not sure what's going to happen the years ahead. But we are in a situation now where societal pressures mean that a lot of young people will have made so-called choices that they will subsequently realize were not the ones they wished they had made.
He's been given the President's Award by the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Bradford Washburn Award by the Museum of Science in Boston, and has been made an Honorary Fellow of the Kavli Institute of Particle Physics, the British Science Association, and the Royal Society. Yet renowned author Bill Bryson claims to have been a terrible student of science in school.
A recent Royal Society event heard him in conversation with Professor Jim Alcalilli, where he spoke about his personal experiences and perspectives on science, from childhood and his school years through to writing the highly successful A Short History of Nearly Everything and editing the Royal Society's 350th anniversary book, Seeing Further.
Well, Bill, here we are in the Royal Society and looking forward, I hope, to our event. I see there's already a queue building.
Yes,
up
it's
outside.
Always, I mean, for me, it's always a little unnerving because, you know, I'm acutely aware that I'm not a scientist and that I've strayed into territory that I haven't earned the right to be in, you know, through academic achievement or anything else, really. But I'm always happy to talk enthusiastically about science. You know, and clearly my perspective is both very narrow and very limited. But, you know, the one thing that I can do is talk about, you know, what I've learned from scientists, which is really, you know, how interested it is what they do and how grateful we should be for what they do.
Do you find it more, I mean, an event like this evening, do you find it easier to tell stories through the writing than to be in front of a live audience?
Yeah, I mean, I would much rather be sitting, you know, I became a writer, I think, because I'm, you know, an introverted personality to begin with. It's a pleasure in a lot of ways to meet people publicly, as you well know. When you write, you don't have a lot of immediate feedback. You don't have any sense of really, you know, response. I mean, it's very indirect. So it's very pleasurable to see that, to meet people who are fans. But my instinct is just to always to fade into the background and to work and not to be a performer or not. Really not to engage with people. I'm more of an eavesdropper than an engager.
Now, you know you're probably slightly losing your Iowa accent having spent so long in Britain. It's fair to say you probably love, despite writing or taking the mickey out of the British, you probably love Britain more than many Brits do. You appreciate it more.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I love it more. But I do appreciate, I mean, I appreciate a lot of things about it. I think, yeah, that's not a special trick. It's just, you know, if you come to something voluntarily, you often see things or appreciate things that people take for granted. I mean, I've seen it working in the opposite direction. I have a British friend who married a girl from Des Moines, Iowa, my hometown, and he loves Des Moines, and he sees things in Des Moines and in Iowa and in Iowans that I had never noticed, never would have known about. And he's interested in things, the history of Iowa, in a way that I never was because I just grew up there and took it for granted. So, yeah, I mean, I do genuinely really, really admire a lot of things about Britain. And I think there are things that the British, I think more than a lot of other people, tend to be fairly dismissive of positive things in their own country. I mean, something we can talk about more later, but I do think that that is a kind of unfortunate case. Keeps them from being insufferable, but it also means that they miss out on a lot of things that they should be very pleased about.
Now, you're here at the Royal Society of Bill to talk, I guess, about your passion for science, but many people will know you better for your travel writing. Was it difficult to make that transition from writing about countries you visited to talking about science?
Not at all, not for me. I mean, I never set out to be a travel writer. It was something I stumbled into. And because my first book was successful, which was a book called The Lost Continent, which was about traveling, going back to America and traveling around America and seeing how it had changed and I had changed in the, at that time, 15 years or so since I had last lived in America. And so it wasn't a conventional travel book anyway, but it was categorized as travel. And when it came time for me to think about a second book, my publisher said to me, there's no question you're going to do it. You're a travel writer now, you know. You've written a successful travel book, so that's what you're going to do. And I was, I wouldn't say bullied, but I was, you know, strongly coaxed into going along that vein for some time. But it was never that was never the expression of any kind of great desire on my part. It was very good. I enjoyed doing it, and I still do enjoy doing that kind of book. But I didn't want to do it exclusively. So when the chance came to branch out a little bit and do other kinds of books, I seized it.
A lot of scientists will know of your book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, which really was quite a large book, popular science, 500 pages plus. I think a lot of popular science writers thought you were sort of encroaching on their territory somehow. You know, here's this guy, he's not even a scientist. How was the book received by the scientific community?
Very generously, I have to say, because I mean, any scientist could pick it to pieces. I mean, it would be very, very easy for you to take your field and just to look at it and say, no, that's just not right. I mean, that's way too superficial, or that's way, you know, he doesn't really understand it. Because at no point can I ever pretend that I really, really understood the underlying science here. But I think most people, and scientists in particular, will recognize that what I was trying to do was talk about, well, this is the way, you know, this is the way it seems to me. This is what I've learned, or I think I've learned. And mostly what I was talking about wasn't saying, here's science and how it works. It was more, here's what I've learned about how scientists do the things they do. Here's how they answered those questions that we all have. Here's how scientists figure things out. And I think because it is really quite admiring of scientists and what they do, they were willing to forgive any factual mistakes or simplifications I made.
And
it's inevitable.
And I believe there's even a website somewhere where you've listed the mistakes that you had found in the book. Is that?
Oh well, no. I no. But I mean, every time I have had a mistake drawn to my attention, I have tried as scrupulously as I can to get it corrected. So I mean, lots and lots of mistakes have been corrected, and it is just amazing the some of the mistakes you make. I mean, I can't think. Offhand in this book, but I do remember that I did a book on Australia, and I had myself sitting on a terrace of a hotel in Brisbane, and I recorded that I watched the sunset over the Pacific Ocean. Well, if you're sitting on the east coast of a country, the sun does not set over the ocean in front of you. I had a clear memory in my head of the water sparkling and the sun going down, so it was obviously setting behind me, but it was lighting the water. It's just, you know, it's very, very easy to make mistakes of that magnitude, which are remarkably foolish and stupid, and yet, you know, we all make them. And it's horrible when that happens. I do try and get them corrected as quickly as I can. I can't actually think of any of that sort that happened in A Short History Nearly Everything, but they do happen all the time. Whether you're a scientist or not, I should say, too.
That's true. Absolutely.
They happen to everybody, you know.
Thanks for listening to this May episode of Our Science. We look forward to bringing you more from the Royal Society next month in our June special episode on diversity in science.
And finally, for this episode, we bring you our monthly Why is Science, which this month comes from Professor Michael Rees, who we heard from earlier at the SCORE conference.
Not very surprisingly, like most people across the globe, I'm in favour of a balanced curriculum for young people until the end of the school leaving age, which is still pretty much 16 in England. So the most important subjects, and I'm quite prepared to say this even at a science conference, the most important subjects are one's main mother tongue, so English in England, and mathematics. After that, the sciences, as they're usually called rather than just science, are probably the most important subject. And this is for a whole range of reasons. It's partly because we live in a time when the sciences have changed the way we see the world. So even for people who are not thinking of having careers in science, to have a decent grounding in science really enables one to be an informed citizen. Actually, when you ask people in their early 20s what they wished they had done more of, you find that quite a lot of people wish they'd done the sciences more. More people wish that than wish they had done humanities more, for example. We're not doing as good a job in this country as we could do of enabling people to continue with the sciences. So I'm passionately in favour of outstanding science teaching in schools, good curricula, strong tradition of practical work, valuing our science technicians.